Hey, quick note before this episode kicks off.
If you're a regular listener to TOEFOP, TOEFOP with Friends, Two Guys, One Cup, or Willosophy, then we're asking for your help.
We want to keep the show free, and that means occasionally throwing some ads in. This is so we can pay our bills for important things like, you know, questionable art by James Fosdyke.
Yeah, but we don't want to support businesses that you don't care about anyway. That'd be annoying for you, it's bad for us, and it's useless for the advertiser.
So what we're asking is to get a bit of info from you that'll help inform the sort of brands we work with.
Yeah, the survey is quick, and everyone who does it goes in the draw to win 100 bucks. Well, a $100 gift voucher anyway.
I mean, that's still more than we get for this podcast. Your input will help us work with the right brands and keep the show free.
There's a link to the survey in the episode description. It closes soon.
Thanks heaps.
A listener production.
The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
I can't remember how we start. It's like
I'm the passenger.
Hello and welcome to TOEFOP with Friends. We're back in the video store for the first time in a long time. It's me, Charlie Clawson, and I'm joined by the maestro of the movies, the pharaoh of the flicks, the sultan of the cinema. It is Guy Davis. Welcome back.
Charlie, it's a pleasure to be back in the video store. And look, I think we were initially stuttering a little bit as we started. We're like, it's been a while since we spoke. How did we actually begin this? But then you got right into the alliteration and the Apollo Creed style nicknames. I felt my heart swell like three sizes, just like the Grinch.
Oh, did you feel your heart swell like Apollo Creed when you got punched in the head by Dolph Lundgren? I was going to say, what's his character's name? Dolph Lundgren was...
By Drago?
Ivan Drago. I mean, how could I forget the name? I mean, Dolph Lundgren and Ivan Drago, no need to come up with the character name. Like, you could have called the character Dolph Lundgren and it has the same kind of weight.
Pretty much, yeah. Have you watched that documentary on Stallone on Netflix?
No, I saw you tweeting about it. You thought it was a bit sanitized. Is that right?
It's a bit authorized, like so many of these things are. I mean, I really enjoyed the Beckham one that's on Netflix as well. But at the same time, that's also, let's watch David cook a portobello mushroom. Let's watch him dancing to Islands in the Stream with the, Posh and the kids. It's like, you get just enough warts, but not all. So you've got the warts, but not the all. Yeah. And likewise with the Arnold one and likewise with this Stallone one. I imagine it's going to be the same with the Robbie Williams one that's out now as well. But they, talk about how during the make of Rocky IV, Dolph Lundgren just hit him in the chest so hard that it basically put him into intensive care and nearly killed him. It's like,
have I ever told you my Dolph Lundgren story about when he was my neighbor in L.A.?
You have not, and been remiss in not sharing this.
I mean, for TOEFOP listeners, you might want to skip ahead, but for anyone who is
specifically
tuned into the video, we got a lot of episodes out of it. But so Will was renting an apartment in West Hollywood, and he said to me one day, "I've seen this like tall blonde guy coming and going from the building. I think Dolph Lundgren might live in my building." And it turns out, Dolph Lundgren had the penthouse suite above Will's apartment, and so I was staying in Will's apartment for a few months while he was back in Australia, and I said to him, "I'm going to make it my mission to befriend Dolph Lundgren," because there was a gym at this apartment complex and I would see him in there. Like, of course you'd see him in there. And I've got to tell you, Guy, I had the biggest like fanboy 80s moment where we're in the gym and, we sort of just nod and say hello and working out. And after he finished his workout, he went into this sort of outdoor courtyard area and he started doing his karate kind of like form, like he was like, it was like a training sequence from an 80s action movie. He was just there doing his form, like, practicing kicks and shit. And I'm like, that's Dolph Lundgren. Like, that's Ivan Drago there practicing karate.
You're watching Red Scorpion in real time.
100%. And so Will and I strategized. I was like, how am I going to befriend him? And I'm like, everyone who goes up to him is always going to bring up Ivan Drago. Like, you need another angle.
You do.
And so I creepily started to research Dolph Lundgren, his interests, what he's into, and I found this TED talk that he did, or maybe I think it was a TEDx talk. It wasn't quite at the high end of the TED talk. It was a TEDx talk. But it was him talking about, it was actually quite an interesting talk. You know, he has a degree in engineering. You know,
he was a Fulbright scholar or something.
Fulbright scholar. Fairly staunchly anti-communist, which is why he came to the States. But he did this talk about like masculinity and, you know, and he grew up in a very sort of macho time. And obviously, you know, he became this symbol of macho culture, but finding that vulnerability, you know, gave him so much more strength and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, it was a great talk. So the next time I was at the gym, I saw him and I was like, hey, Dolph, so you don't know me. My name's Charlie. I'm just renting the apartment below you. And he said, hello. And I could sort of see him doing that celebrity thing. He's like, oh, I've got like, I'm waiting for okay. the Ivan Drago thing to come or can I get a photo? And I'd said to him, oh, you know, by the way, I just caught your TED Talk a couple of weeks ago. Fantastic. I loved it. And dude, you should have seen him light up. Like he was saying, he was like, oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that, yeah, it was interesting. Someone came to me because I'd written an article and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, it was amazing. And so we sat there and I had 5 minutes in the presence of Dolph Lundgren.
That is marvelous. What would be the in for you in that case, Charlie? I mean, because, I mean, would people come to you and say,
I don't know.
liked you on Getaway?
Yeah.
I mean, or should people bring up Canal Road? Or
I don't know. I mean, because I do a podcast, people pretty much get an insight into a lot of my personality. I don't know that there is any one thing that would bring you closer to me. Maybe if you got a real niche, like if you listen to The Video Store, for instance, and, you know, I brought up, you know, films that I love, you know, like Die Hard with a Vengeance. If someone came up to me and said, you know what, I actually think Die Hard with a Vengeance is almost as good as Die Hard, then you got my attention because I'm all right. Okay, continue. What would get to you? What would someone have to say to you to sort of like warm the cockles of your heart? How would you immediately warm to a stranger?
Oh, gosh, if they I think they said, oh, well, you look like an elder Bruce Willis as opposed to an elder Paul Giamatti.
So you just want compliments.
I do, essentially. I want my ego stroked all the time.
Well, let's get into today's topic. This is once again, I rely on Guy to come up with all the best topics for the video store. I'll let you explain it because it has been inspired by another movie podcast, I believe.
A little bit, yeah. But, I mean, I was thinking about life as a film buff or film nerd or whatever sort of term we go by these days, and how if it's sort of not intrinsic to your personality but part of your identity that you're into movies or into popular culture, but particularly movies, people will sort of say, oh, well, what's your favorite movie? Particularly, you know, if you've worked as a reviewer or if you've worked in the industry like you have, it'll be like, oh, what's your favorite? I mean, what do you really enjoy?
And I think the period of time you also – feel a compulsion to rank. Like I know when I was a younger nerd, I was like, well, I need to be prepared for this answer. So I would start categorizing and ranking films in terms of like all-time favorites, then by genre and all that kind of stuff.
It's funny you mentioned this because about maybe 10 years ago when I was still reviewing movies for the Geelong Advertiser here in my hometown, I got commissioned to write this big sort of weekend fold-out. This is when newspapers were actually viable in terms of like we can do special supplements. It's like, we'd like you to do your 100 best movies. And I'm like, well, that's too much of an ask, but I can break it down into like categories. I can do top 10s in various things and I can give you my top 10 overall. And I swear to God, it was one of the hardest asks ever. But, you know, breaking it down that way was kind of good. But then when it was like, okay, these are my actual top 10, it's like, well, I want to be true to myself, but at the same time, I don't want to be too much of a normie, but at the same time, too much of a
niche
film nerd. Yeah. So you've got to just strike the right balance.
It's an impossible question to answer, though, because I think that it's like art, you know, it's so subjective. And depending on, you know, what you feel like watching, where you were in your life when you saw that film, like how often have you had an experience where you've loved something and then gone back to it? Like I had a rude awakening with – I used to rave about Hot Tub Time Machine. I was like, that was one of the most enjoyable, fun, loose, freewheeling comedies of recent memory. And I watched it again like 6 months ago. I'm like, wow, this is – there's so much shit that would not fly today. It's really like a lot of it's dated really badly, but it's also, I don't know what headspace I was in when Top Time Machine tickled my fancy, but things have changed.
I think the thing is, when you watch Hot Tub Time Machine, the first time you go, this is actually a bit better and a bit deeper than I expected a movie Hot Tub called Hot Tub Time Machine to be.
Yeah.
And then you get a few more miles on the meter, you get a little more distance from it, you go, actually, this is pretty much what a movie called Hot Tub Time Machine is
exactly.
like.
Exactly. Exactly. I suppose it's not Hot Tub Time Machine's fault. It's my fault. I built it up too much.
Yeah. But there's a great line in the movie 12 Monkeys where Bruce Willis and Madeleine Stowe, they're sort of hiding out from whoever's chasing them. They're at a cinema, I think, watching Vertigo, and Bruce Willis is sort of unstuck in time, and he's like, I don't know if I've been here before, I don't know if I've seen this before, but he talks about how, a movie is different every time you see it because you're different every time you see it, and, so what your favourites are going to be, of course, different, going to differ, I don't know, based on your experiences, based on the more you know about life and the more you know about art, the more you know about yourself as well. Mm. But I think when it comes to, someone who maybe you've met for the first time and you want to make a good first impression on asking, oh, what's your favorite movie? I don't think you necessarily want to go full, these are my niche interests.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this is going to sound really snobby, and I apologize in advance to every AFL footballer ever existed, but, there was that running joke for a while. It's like, if you ask a footballer what their favorite movie is, it's usually Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah,
which is wholly valid because that's a really good movie.
Yeah. And now it's changed because on our AFL podcast, like that was every time we had a segment where we'd read the pocket profiles that the players at the interviews they'd do. And Shawshank was definitely up there, but it's now a new generation because they keep recycling, new generations of players. And it's The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight is so often rated. And I'm like, I guess if you were 13 when The Dark Knight came out or 10, it would be like your Heat. It has the same kind of, it's got Batman, but it still feels kind of like a real movie. So if you were trying to tread that line of populism, but something that feels like a real movie, then The Dark Knight probably makes sense.
Yeah, but if you're sort of priding yourself as a bit of a film aficionado, then you've got to thread the needle pretty carefully. It's like, okay, well, I want something that's not too esoteric, but it shows that I've got taste. Something mainstream but with a high thread count, let's say. I was thinking about that, and there was at least one part. The Twitter account of a podcast that I enjoy was talking about The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is, I'm sorry, I'm sort of not burying the lead here, but I'm jumping ahead because the essentially movies that you will say that are good, that are good to you. You're not lying or misrepresenting, but it's maybe not your immediate go-to. I was thinking about this the other day for another reason because, recently we lost Friends star Matthew Perry, and I was rewatching an episode of Friends. It's not something I do all that often, but I thought I'd like to revisit some of Matthew's greatest hits. And there was the episode where they're doing, I think it's Rachel and Phoebe are doing the quiz with Joey and Chandler, sort of trying to figure out who knows each other best. And I think one of the questions was, what does Rachel say is her favorite movie? Dangerous Liaisons. What is Rachel's actual favorite movie? Weekend at Bernie's. So you may not cop to, your very, very favorite movie being the best movie or the one that you like the most, but you want to give a good impression. So, me, Talented Mr. Ripley is one of those, certainly.
I've done a lot of development with Screen Australia where they'll, as a writer, you'll get partnered with a script producer or a script editor or a script consultant. And, the first discussions you'll always have is, what's your North Star? What are your frames of reference? What films do you like? And that is exactly when this question comes into full focus because you're like, all right, I'm sitting with someone and I want to impress them because I'm going to be working with them and, we're doing the very serious job of, writing a screenplay. But at the same time, I need to be true to myself. And I remember the last screenplay I had that went through Screen Australia development, the consultant and I were on completely different pages. Like she started naming all these obscure foreign films, like French movies that I'd never heard of. And I was like, Back to the Future, Aliens, like all the most like mainstream, like popcorn movies. But I also feel like that's kind of what makes movie making fantastic because, you know.
Absolutely. And,
you know, like.
And, you're naming. Oh, sorry, man.
I was going to say, like Paul Thomas Anderson being a fan of Adam Sandler films, but not really wanting to make an Adam Sandler film, but making Punch Drunk Love, that's when you get the best of both worlds, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's always funny when you hear about these very esoteric filmmakers who've got not lowbrow taste, but, you know, it's like, oh, Christopher Nolan is really into MacGruber.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the funniest is that Terrence Malick was like a huge fan of Zoolander.
Oh, really?
It's like, that's so incongruous. But it's funny, you're name-checking things like Back to the Future and Aliens, and these are like really great examples of the populist form, though. I mean, a film writer that I really respect was talking on Twitter the other day about Aliens and just how, you know, this movie's designed as a cash-in. It's a sequel to Alien. It's got no right to be as good as it is.
Literally how James Cameron pitched it. He wrote Aliens and put a dollar sign.
Is that true? Or is
I've heard him say that. So, I mean, maybe he's just adopted the legend. But I think that it's funny because, you know, if you were to take the Footy Pocket Profile as the bellwether, you're not going to be getting your obscure you know, art house films put in there. So it's like, it just really depends on who you're talking to. I mean, it'd be amazing to have like Jordan
McGoey. I don't think Tom Hawkins is
peak, you know, his favorite film or something.
He's going to be sort of name-checking Antonioni or something like that.
Well, let's get into it. So the way we've decided to break it up is we've brought in two nominations each, two nominations for our normie mainstream and two nominations for our niche film nerd, cred bro films. I've let the cat out of the bag. So I'll start with my first normie, which is Back to the Future. And I'll get into that because that was the film that I brought up with this script consultant and she had never seen Back to the Future. And my jaw hit the floor. Now, here's what I love about Back to the Future. I mean, obviously, like you say to anyone, time travel movie, it is normally the first film that comes to mind. Like, it is pretty much defined a genre. Like, it's the high benchmark that all other time travels aspire to.
Yeah, you're not thinking Hot Tub Time Machine in this regard, then.
Even like Hot Tub Time Machine reference Back to the Future. Like, the Avengers have to reference Back to the Future. Like, it's impossible not to now.
Oh yeah. I think it's either that or the Terminator that when you're talking about time travel. But yeah, I think Back to the Future is the one that really centers it as a concept and has its own, I guess, rules and philosophy about the nature of time travel. I mean, I'm sure I've said this in the past when we've talked about movies, but the great thing about Looper is that, you know, the minute anyone starts to talk about the
paradoxes.
The paradox and all that. It's like, we're not going to talk about this at all. We'll be here all day making diagrams with straws. We're not doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like, okay, yeah, just, you know, make your own rules and abide by your own logic. Yeah, and that's what Back to the Future does. Sorry, man, I'm interrupting your...
No, that's fine. No, I mean, it's sort of Back to the Future, like there was that heyday of, you know, the sort of early 80s when Spielberg and Zemeckis were just the absolute, like, pinnacle of their crowd-pleasing powers. And the magic that is in that film, like, permeates every frame. And it's actually, like, a pretty flawless screenplay. Like in terms of the way things are set up and the way they're paid off, the messaging, sure. Like, you know, we can debate that, whether or not it's like an endorsement of Reagan's America and materialism and all that kind of stuff. But just that simple fact of, like, you know, the hero's journey and a guy starting with nothing, having to go through this like life lesson and learn more about his parents in order to kind of, you know, bring home the elixir at the end. And I know it's a good film because I've seen it 100 times. But every time George punches out Biff, I get a little rush of adrenaline. Like, it is just cinema magic. You can't love that film.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, again, sorry to keep going back to social media. It's not where I spend all my time, I assure you. But, I mean, someone was asking a prompt question the other day about, you know, when were you in a cinema and the crowd was just, yeah. as one. And yeah, for me, it was being at the Forum Cinema in Melbourne back in 85 when Back to the Future came out. And when George punches out Biff, honestly, it's like you were at Ali versus Foreman or something. Everyone was just standing, going, yes, incredible. And then, you know, on top of that, that's when not long after that, Michael J. Fox invents rock and roll.
Yeah.
Everyone dug that as well.
And that brings up another thing that, like, I was interviewing the two members of Silverchair, the guys who've released the book a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I always ask this question of musicians because to me, like, time travel, sure, whatever else, you can stretch credibility or you know, my suspension of disbelief. But the bit where he turns to the band and he says, hey, guys, this is a blues riff and B, watch me for the changes and try to keep up. And then they do a flawless rendition of Johnny B. Goode. I said to, like, Chris and Ben from Silverchair, I was like, is that possible? Like, if a guy came up to you, a guy you never met before, and said, hey, this is a blues riff and B, watch me for the changes and try to keep up. And they said, yeah, I think so. So I'm like, fuck, that film's amazing. It's
wow. Because that always struck me as something like, yeah, can you actually do that? I mean, I've got no musical aptitude whatsoever. But
apparently real musicians say it is possible. And the other thing about Back to the Future that I think makes it special is that because it is still owned by Bob Gale and Zemeckis, they have not had to succumb to the reboot trend. Like, and for everything I've read, they don't want to. Like, there hasn't even been like a knockoff sequel. There's not even like a prequel series or a TV series or anything like that. And it's like, God, if they can keep this thing trapped in amber and just never let it be remade, then the legend will only grow. I don't think it's possible, but I'm hoping.
I don't think it is either. I mean, it really is just a beautiful combination of elements that all works so well together, whether it's, you know, direction, script. I mean, you think about what we could have got. I mean, I like Eric Stoltz as much as the next person. I think he's a very, very good actor. But you look at even just still images of him in that as Marty McFly before they replaced him.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it doesn't feel right, does it? Having Michael J. Fox in the lead is just so marvelous as well.
They had shot 6 weeks of that movie before they replaced him. Like, that's huge. That's extraordinary.
That's a
lot. Like, that,
yeah.
I mean, if you were monitoring that, if you were in the trades or whatever, or even, like, you know, working the studio system, you'd be hearing about this film. You'd be like, this is a disaster. This is going to be like the Heaven's Gate, Universal's Heaven's Gate or something like that. Like, it's a huge disaster.
Yeah, well, I mean, any sort of talk of reshoots on anything nowadays, I mean, the poor old Marvel seem to have got kneecapped before it even, you know, hit cinemas because they're talking about, oh, they've had to do so many reshoots on this. And then, you know, Disney/Marvel goes into damage control and say, well, no, that's how our movies are made. We sort of factor reshoots into every production. But yeah, everyone's going, no, it's a bomb. It's flawed. It's you know, all screwed up. But, I had no idea they were that far into production on Back to the Future before they replaced Stoltz with Fox.
I mean, poor Eric Stoltz. Like, I mean, do you think he still wakes up in a cold sweat? You know? Like, there must be some part of him that is like, Jesus Christ. But it's just everything, the casting's perfect. Like, Crispin Glover, you know, just being the most Crispin Glover ever, like just amazing. Christopher Lloyd, perfectly cast. Leah Thompson, perfectly cast. And then, he played Biff.
Thomas Wilson.
Tom Wilson. Like, one of the great unheralded performances of all time, considering like the variations he plays of this bully and so unlikable. William Zabka-esque, like he needs a William Zabka-esque like second act, right?
He really does, doesn't he?
He was the PE teacher in Freaks and Geeks. I remember that.
And a really nice guy. I mean, that was really astute casting on the part of Freaks and Geeks that they got the ultimate 80s bully to play a sort of an 80s nice guy or rebranded him as such. Yeah, but it's hard to put a foot wrong with Back to the Future. I mean, and people are certainly trying. I think the fact that it is so airtight that you've got a lot of Cinema Sins type of YouTube critics going, we've got to find nits to pick here. We've got to find flaws. And it's really, really difficult to do so. I think it was funny that John Mulaney on one of his stand-up comedy bits did a whole bit on Back to the Future and how I think he was pretending to be Zemeckis and Gale pitching it to Universal, pitching it to Spielberg and saying, you know, talking about not the inherent flaws of it, but the inherent weirdness of it that this guy goes back in time and Yeah,
he tries to seduce his mother. Like, and it's
his mum's coming on to him, and then then he punches out his mum's rapist at the end.
It's like that's the other crazy thing. It's like when you really dig into the deeper subject matter, it's a very dark film with really risque subject matter, but it's done with such charm and aplomb.
And this was basically a movie for not kids, but certainly for teenagers and young adults back in the day. I mean, this was a Steven Spielberg production that was in in thousands of cinemas. And kids, go see the feel good romp of the summer.
I think it got ingrained into my subconscious because my sister was obsessed with Michael J. Fox, Family Ties, and Back to the Future, and she smuggled a tape recorder into one of the 15 times she saw it at the cinema and recorded it. And so we would listen to it at home, like just before bed, we would like put on the recording, the bootleg, Back to the Future, and listen to the audio version of the film. So I think somehow it just wormed its way into my brain. It's like it feels part of my DNA.
I think that's a part of a thing with Generation X types like myself, and I would dare say you, Charlie.
Yes, I just sneak into Gen X.
There was a lot of repetition viewing of, you'd hire the VHS and have it for a few days, and it's like, I'm going to watch that one again. And it just seeps in via osmosis and becomes part of your DNA.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier your first nomination for your normie choice, which is The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Indeed, yeah. Now, this is a film that I guess, like a lot of sort of highbrow-ish movies from the 90s and I guess the early 2000s, got an unfortunate asterisk next to us these days because it's a Miramax production. It's got the name Harvey Weinstein in the credits. But I think if you go back through that era, you're going to find a lot of movies like this that have that unfortunate taint to it because, for all his flaws and faults and general toxicity, and there's a high level of that. I mean, Miramax also just really managed to produce a lot of stuff that was for the multiplex, for the mainstream, but also just really well made. They would assemble great talent. They would have their fingerprints all over it, but it essentially is like, we're getting the best of the best here, and we're going to do it to win Oscars, do it to win acclaim, all that kind of stuff. But a lot of great stuff got put out into the cinematic universe as a result. And for mine, Talented Mr. Ripley is like a real, just an exemplar of the form. I mean, you look at the people who are involved in it on both sides of the camera, and it's really just this murderous row of terrific talent, either established or on the verge of like taking it to the next level.
Yeah. I mean, this, if you know how every year they do honest movie posters, if this was an honest movie poster, it'd just be classy picture because that's what it reeks of, just class in every department.
And if you say, what's a good movie is The Talented Mr. Ripley, it's not necessarily the first movie that comes to people's minds, but then I think enough people have seen it over time or enough people know about it and about who's involved with it, they kind of go, you know what, that is pretty good. Yeah. And this person who brought it up is pretty good by extension.
I see what you're playing here. Yeah. And just so many great performances. Like, what a cast. Philip Seymour Hoffman, perhaps the greatest character entrance in cinema history. Like, was he drives his car into the Trevi Fountain, just gets out, says he wants to have sex with every woman he sees, and it's just brilliant.
This complete American, ugly American vulgarian in beautiful, tasteful post-war Italy.
Tommy, he's peeping Tommy. Where you would start to peeping Tommy.
Honestly, he's the one person who clocks that Tom Ripley is in fact this a bit of a bad egg.
Yeah,
and I mean, I don't know if he's actually doing it for the right reasons, but I think he's realizing that the Ripley's interloping on this nice sort of cushy setup that he's got going on. But I mean, just look at the first few actors on the call sheet. I mean, Matt Damon's in the lead. It's Jude Law's essentially breakout role, and I mean, I keep sort of restating my heterosexuality, but you look at Jude Law in this and just go, oh, my God.
No man has ever looked better in a movie than Jude Law in this film. Like that's the character, right? Like, he's meant to be the most, like, charismatic, attractive man, and they've just cast it perfectly. And he's He is beautiful. There's not a word
he
for
really
it.
He really is, yeah. It's funny. I mean, there was an adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's novel, The Talent of Mr. Ripley, made in the 50s, I think, called Purple Noon. And it stars the other most, you know, beautiful man to ever step on screen, Alain Delon. And it's like, okay, what is it about these Ripley stories that just attract hot dudes? you've got Jude Law, you've got Gwyneth Paltrow, who's kind of in the midst of her, you know, real golden moment. Cate Blanchett, not making her debut,
I forgot about that. Yeah.
I think she's actually not above the title. She might be the first name below the title. Of course, Hoffman, who's just so incredible in it. Jack Davenport, who I think is a really good, really underrated English actor. And then you've got these other terrific sort of veteran guys, like the late, great Philip Baker Hall's in there. And a guy I really like named James Rebhorn.
Yeah, plays Dickie's dad, right?
He does, yeah. And I mean, he had a really good late 90s because he had a great role in this, and he's really good in David Fincher's The Game as well. I mean, he's just a very average-looking gentleman. I don't mean that as a slight, but
he's a character actor. He's got that face.
Yeah, he's a real everyman.
Something.
Yeah, but occasionally it's like, we're going to give you a little bit to do here. Take it and run with it. And he'll just imbue these characters with a bit of inner life, and I find that really interesting. But that's across the board in Talent, Mr. Ripley. And then, of course, you know, behind the camera, you've got Anthony Minghella, who, I don't know, that's a guy I miss almost every day. And I mean, I don't know how well he'd be functioning in, you know, 2020s Hollywood. But,
yeah. What superhero franchise would he have been in order to keep working? I mean, the kinds of films he made, they just don't make anymore. Like, he's just.
No, yeah. Or they make them as six-part miniseries for HBO Max or Netflix.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, a lot of people are talking about, you know, they don't make them like they used to. They sort of do, but the delivery system has changed.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah, but no, Tell Them Mr. Ripley is one that's like, yeah, you bang on when you say if it's the poster just says classy movie.
Yeah.
Even it's got the poster has that sort of burnished glow to it. It kind of looks
the whole
it looks
film
high
feels
end.
Golden, doesn't it? Like there's like it's
it
like
really does.
Jude Law's tan, you know, the locations. Yeah. Like, everything just feels golden, perfectly golden brown.
But again, I mean, like Back to the Future. And I think this may be the first time that Back to the Future and the Talent of Mr. Ripley have ever been compared and contrasted. It's a pretty bleak and dark and kind of nasty movie in a lot of ways, you know, in terms of just the emotional damage and the physical damage that people can wreak upon one another. I mean, you're dealing with some very, damaged individuals in this movie. And I think Minghella he's not too afraid to delve into that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's walked a very fine line and made it quite a palatable movie that deals with some fairly unpalatable stuff.
And I think the violence, like when Dickie, spoilers, if you haven't seen the movie, but when Dickie's killed on the boat, like it's such a shocking death. Like you just don't know that Tom is capable of this. He seems like such a bullied, put upon nerd. And then, like, doesn't his face separate? Like, there's a slice of an oar, and like, it separates his face from the rest of his head. It's pretty fucking gross.
It's like, oh, the ultimate crime! You fucked up Jude Law's beautiful face.
How dare you?
You monster, Tom Ripley.
All right, my other normie pick, and I don't know if this actually is probably a normie pick. It's not mainstream like Back to the Future, but I think it. I wanted to bring up a Richard Linklater film, and I love Richard Linklater, and there's a lot that I. You know, I was going to say School of Rock, and then I'm like, oh, I feel like that's too similar in terms of crowd pleasing to the Back to the Future. And then I was like, well, Boyhood was like sort of Oscar recognized, and I really like Boyhood, but maybe that's more niche. And then I settled on the film that I come back to the most, which is Dazed and Confused. I just love this film. If you haven't seen it, it's set in 1976, a group of kids in Texas. In typical Linklater fashion, it has a fairly languid pace as you sort of drift around between these different groups. Like you got your freshmen, you got your seniors, and all their stories interact as all leading towards this one big kind of end of school party. But Linklater, I mean, God, talk about an eye for casting. Like, just take a look at the talent that is in this film. Parker Posey, Ben Affleck, Joey Lauren Adams, Adam Goldberg. Like, it's just a who's who. Is Cole Hauser in it as well?
Cole Hauser's in this.
Cole Hauser. And it just reeks of authenticity. And I say that as someone who didn't grow up in Texas in the late 70s. But everything about it just feels so authentic. And I think what makes it feel so authentic is that a lot of the characters, like Ben Affleck in particular, are so cruel. But even like the senior girls, yeah, like the initiation, they put the freshmen through in the first, you know, 10 minutes. It's like, this is fucking horrible. But it's done with no judgment. It's done in that very Linklater observational kind of way.
Very much so. I'm glad you mentioned Parker Posey straight up because, honestly, yeah, the most terrifying character in the film, or dare I say any film.
Yeah.
I mean, just this – it's like she could take on all of the mean girls in Mean Girls and just reduce them to ash.
Yeah.
But at the same time, utterly appealing or utterly kind of like captivating. It's like, oh, I would, you know, do anything for – you know, for you to look my way just even for a moment, but yeah, you would then tear me to shreds. I think one of the great things too about Dazed and Confused, and it's great that you named it in your normie picks, is that, it's kind of almost got art film bona fides. Mm. I mean, it wasn't a hit. When it was first released and was sort of regarded as a bit of a flop. And, you know, as time has gone by, it's been, you know, reclaimed and so many people watched it. It's in the Criterion Collection. Which is also a great movie.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody wants them. It's a fantastic film. But it's also got that thing where, as you mentioned about the casting, enough of its ensemble are now household names that you kind of say, oh, well, you know, this was Matthew McConaughey's first movie.
Yeah.
And it gives you a bit of an in to it. It's like, you know, if you want to recommend it to someone, it's like, yeah, it's got Ben Affleck and it's got Parker Posey and all these people that you may recognize. Hey, that's Renee Zellweger then there for a second. And people go, oh, wow, really? So you get to maintain your sort
Mila
of film
Hohovich.
Nerd. Mila Jovovich.
Yeah, before she
pre-Resident Evil.
Clearly still grappling with English at that stage. I think she hadn't quite. They don't give her many lines.
Not really, no. you're right. It's a movie that's got a lot of great talent attached to it anyone can put it on and relate to it. I mean, as you said, you don't have to grow up in Texas in the 70s. Yeah. It's relatable.
It's got
to
that Breakfast Club energy where it's like, what social group do you most identify with? Because you'll get at least, you know, 5 to 10 minutes with that group and you'll be able to identify. You'll be part of the party as well. Like the characters I identify with most are the nerds, which is the, Adam Goldberg, Giovanni Ribisi's sister. I forget her name.
Marisa Ribisi. Yeah. And is it Anthony Rapp?
That Anthony Rapp, because they're the kind of the guys who feel a bit too cool and above it all. But, you know, I still want to be part of the crowd, but, you know, have that the sense of humor and cynicism as a self-defense mechanism.
But the other great thing is that Linklater really taps into is he recognizes how all these groups do interact.
Yeah.
It's never, you know, as it is in a lot of American teen movies, like that we all know that social strata system exists, but it's also very, very fluid. It's never just nerds hang with nerds and jocks hang with jocks. It's like, no, you're all in the same ecosystem and occasionally your paths are going to cross. And it's not even going to cross in a hostile way. I mean, I think McConaughey, you know, he tries to pick up Marisa.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Why'd you ditch those two nerds and come to the party?
That is such a perfect moment because it really encapsulates all those insecurities you have as a teenage guy. When a good-looking, confident dude like a McConaughey comes in and charms the pants off a girl you know and then walks off, and your response is to go, oh, what a creep, what a weirdo. But what you really know is, oh, my God, I wish I was like that. I wish I had half his confidence.
I love that, it cuts to Marisa Ribisi fixing her hair in the mirror. It's like, I thought he was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, the specificity of it is very much Linklater's, you know, lived experience growing up in Texas in the 70s. But the universality of it belongs to all of us. I mean, that whole late teen, early adult figuring out where you fit in the world, figuring out where you stand, what your values are, what you're going to believe in, and what you're going to represent. Yeah, I mean, that's true for everybody.
Yeah, and it's funny too because there's also a moment in it which. I mean, there's so many moments that feel so authentic, but it's when they actually end up at the party, you know, the big blowout or whatever in the woods. And Adam Goldberg bumps that, not William Catt, what's his name, that actor's name?
Nicky Catt.
Nicky Catt. And Nicky Catt is this scary kind of tough guy who wants to fight him. Mm-hmm. And we've all had that incident where you've accidentally bumped a guy or whatever, and suddenly someone has decided they want to hurt you, and you go through this thing of like, why me? What did I do? And then his decision to go, well, I've got to just stand up for myself because everyone's laughing at me. And he's like, now this will be easy. Look, these things always blow over. We'll just get into a scrap.
Nobody likes a fight.
Straight away. And so he goes in and no one pulls them apart. It's such a brilliant moment of comedy where it's like he's such a nerd. He's thought through it, and then nothing that he thinks is going to happen pans out.
Oh, the saddest thing though at the end though, I mean, it is eventually broken up, but he's, you know, really copped a few terrible hits and, you know, just been embarrassed in front of everybody. But, you know, he's just trying so hard to say to his friend, it didn't look that bad, did I? I mean, I got one or two in, didn't I? I mean, it wasn't like I got my ass kicked and everyone's like, no. It was a fight. It was a legitimate fight.
Yeah.
It really wasn't.
It's so good. Yeah. All right, what's your second normie pick?
My second normie pick, we're going all the way back to 1989, I believe. And the guy who made this, well, I can't, you know, he's not doing too badly because he ended up scripting most of the Harry Potter movies. So I imagine he's, you know, sleeping on a pile of money surrounded by many beautiful ladies now. But it's a guy named Steve Kloves, or Steve Kloves. I'm not sure of the exact pronunciation, but he's only like written and directed two or three movies. But his debut it was a movie called The Fabulous Baker Boys. Mm. And again, I hate to sound terribly nostalgic and piney for yesteryear when I say, oh, they don't make them like this anymore. But this would really be, I mean, this was not a big budget movie, but it had like, I think it was made for something like maybe $9 or $10 million back in 89 or whatever, released by a relatively major studio, had names in it. And I think these days we're kind of like, no, we can't make this for any more than three. And, or, Amazon Prime or Apple decides to make it. And it's not that it does, that these things don't get made anymore, because actually movies like this do get made, but they don't really get talked about in the same way, or they don't get promoted in the same way. Yeah. And so they tend to vanish under the radar.
This is a classic example, I think, of what we used to have, a movie star driven system where, well, you get Jeff Bridges and Michelle Pfeiffer, here's $20 million, you can go make a movie. Nowadays, it's like, well, you need either $100 million and you need Margot Robbie or, you know, Ryan Reynolds or Blair, you know, something like that. Whereas back then it was like, no, people are coming to see Michelle Pfeiffer, or they're coming to see Jeff. No offense, Bo. I'm sure there was a – I'm sure you had your own draw.
There's a reason your third name on the call sheet, Bo.
But I think, you know, come see Jeff Bridges and Michelle Pfeiffer be sexy. And that was a selling point. But now that doesn't exist anymore, because it's either going to be an existing property, a superhero, horror, something like that. Whereas, you know, we used to love movie stars back in the day. And my God, Michelle Pfeiffer, we've talked about Batman Returns on the show before, but like, she had a period, like a 5-year run, where it was just like, oh my God, she's just in the zone.
Yeah, we're in the real supernova period of Michelle Pfeiffer here. I mean, she's starting the ascendancy. And but at the same time, you know, you mentioned, oh yeah, we got movie stars like Jeff Bridges and Michelle Pfeiffer. Back at this stage, they're not necessarily box office guarantees. It's not like putting, say, you know, Tom Cruise on the poster or something like that. These are like, oh, I recognize these names, and yeah, they're, you know, empirically they're good looking people, and this movie appears to be quite sexy. Here's my money. Yeah. But it's not necessarily a guarantee. Now, having said all this, I'm about to contradict my own argument, because, you know, go back a few years, and you've got Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone in La La Land, which is, it's not the same as Fabulous Baker Boys, although I think, you know, you could draw a bit of a through line between the two of them. They've got a same sort of, they've got a musical energy to them, clearly, but they've also got a bit of a melancholic edge to them. So it's, yeah, not like these movies don't exist, but they need to be nurtured a lot more in order to break out and become sort of more of the, I don't know, get more in the public eye. But, the gist of the Fabulous Baker Boys is you have the titular Baker Boys. That's Jack and Frank. They're these brothers who are playing every piano bar in every, you know, three-star hotel in – where is it set? I want to say Chicago, but I think it's
doesn't say where.
Maybe even Seattle.
They're a Seattle-based duo, piano duo.
Yeah. But they're, you know, if you're having a drink at the Marriott on a Thursday night on your business trip, the Fabulous Baker Boys are the guys on the 88 keys, across, you know, playing all your old favorites. You know, not so terrible that you're going, oh, my God, get a load of these guys, but not so good that you're going to, you know, remember them. So, you know, they're getting by. Frank is the one who Frank is played by Beau Bridges. He's the one who's like, yeah, this is our career. You know, we're making not a bad living at this. You know, we get to play music all the time. Jack is just this self-loathing would-be jazz purist who's, yeah, just hating it more and more. They realize that the act's getting stale. They need to bring in a singer. They have an audition where all these dreadful singers come in. Then Susie Diamond, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, comes in, knocks their socks off. Jack, of course, is a bit of a womanizer. Frank is saying, please don't sleep with Michelle Pfeiffer, which, you know, how are you going how can you not? Sorry. And that disrupts the wonderful success that the Fabulous Baker Boys were enjoying when Michelle Pfeiffer joined the group. Mm. It's just a terrific character study about people who are on the verge of success but also perpetually on the verge of failure. They're their own worst enemies in a lot of ways. Maybe they need each other, but at the same time, they can't stand each other.
You know what's interesting about Michelle Pfeiffer too is that for someone who looks like she does, she always seemed interested in playing characters that had like significant flaws. Like she never really played like, you know, princesses or, you know, people beyond reproach. They're always kind of damaged or there was some kind of issue or they had low self-esteem, even if they looked like she does. Like she was always very interested in characters that had a bit of complexity to them.
Very much the case, yeah. I mean, I think she first really caught most people's attention with Scarface, didn't she, back in 83 or so. And even then, I mean,
oh, yeah, so you're going to rule out Grease too, just like that?
So many people are trying to reclaim Grease 2. I don't know if I can get on that bandwagon just yet. Well, if we're reclaiming Michelle Pfeiffer, we've got to reclaim Maxwell Caulfield. I don't know if I can go that far yet. But, yeah, I mean, Elvira in Scarface is, yeah, clearly this messed up person who's just ended up, you know, sucked into the orbit of Tony Montana. And I mean,
well, even like Suki so in Witches of Eastwick just can't stop getting pregnant. Like it's got all these kids to different men. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, she's interesting actor.
Yeah, she's never playing the golden girl or anything like that. There's always a bit of tarnish on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, for someone who looks like Michelle Pfeiffer does, it would be kind of easy to just play glamorous people. Mm. And no, she always tended to go for something with a bit of smear on it, which I think is just marvelous. And it's she's so wonderful in this and, you know, shows terrific singing chops as well. I mean, it's kind of, I hate to use the overused term iconic, but, you know, she's writhing around in the red dress on top of the piano singing Making Whoopee while Jeff Bridges is playing the piano. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's awakening a lot of feelings in a lot of people. Yeah, but at the same time, she's also this chain-smoking ex-call girl, I believe. I think she sort of talks about having a bit of escorting in her past and, you know, a bit foul-mouthed and all this kind of stuff. It's, you know, it's a really rich character. All three of them are really rich characters and they all interact in very, very interesting ways. And for Steve Kloves to write and direct this, I think he was probably in his late 20s when he did so. Yeah, it's just it's a pretty remarkable feat. But, yeah, this is just feels like a movie that's got – it's the kind of movie you pour yourself a whiskey and, you know, sort of watch a bit later in the evening and go, yeah, Jack, I can relate. So I think saying to someone, it's like, you know what's a good movie is The Fabulous Baker Boys. Again, they'll kind of look at you, this person's got hitherto unsuspected depth.
Yeah, that's good. It's good because it's enough. It's people know it. They know it. They know the red dress scene at least to know it.
Yes.
But then it's sort of still niche enough that it's like, oh, this man's intriguing. I like the way this guy reads into text. he seeks deeper meaning within mainstream fare. Well, let's now shift our attention to the more niche nominations. And I retracted one. I sent you one last night that I retracted because I'm like, it's been a while since I've seen it and I would really like to give it a read. I watched the trailer for it. The film is Hard Boiled, John Woo's Hard Boiled. And, I watched a trailer online and I was like, fuck, I'd forgotten how good this is. And it actually gave me an appetite to go back and watch it again. But I also, because I hadn't seen it since like probably when it came out, like 91, 92. And my God, like so many imitators since. Like Michael Bay's entire directing style looks like it's come straight from this. That epic kind of just like wild camera moves with intense choreography and explosions and sparks and neon lighting and stuff. Like it's just beautiful, like peak John Woo.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got Chow Yun-fat just being like, you know, the Clint Eastwood of Asia, you know, Tony Leung being slick and sophisticated. Oh. Like it's got so much going on. But we're not talking about that because I didn't get a chance to review it properly. And what I remembered was a film that I'd rented but hadn't got around to watching, which was a film that not only I love, but I know amongst my filmmaking friends, this is held up as one of the greatest kind of filmmaking documentaries of all time, and that is American Movie. Now, if you haven't seen American Movie, like it's about this guy, Mark, Borchardt. Borchardt, who is a 30 years old, lives at home with his mother in Milwaukee. But has this dream, and that dream is to make his horror film Northwestern. And so the film starts with you see him sort of, you know, bringing together all his mates and these actors he's brought together, but they can't get the funds together to make this feature film. So instead, he goes back to this unfinished 35-minute short horror film. Now, it's some debate around this. It's either Coven or Coven. I think it's Coven if it has an umlaut, but it's Coven is the way it should be pronounced.
I don't want it to rhyme with oven.
And this is just a perfect example of if you have the right subject for a documentary, then, you know, half your work's done, because it's not just Mark, but it is the supporting characters, his uncle Bill, his best mate Mike Schenck, RIP Mike Schenck, I think he passed away a couple of months ago.
Rest in peace, Mike Schenck.
But he's one of the most endearing, adorable people ever put on film. I remember Glendon Ivan, who directed The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart and a bunch of other Aussie films. This is his favorite film of all time, and I remember him, when this film came out, him saying to me, I've written to the studio because I want to get a copy of Mike's album. And sure enough, about 3 months later in the mail, Mike Schenck's album, Songs I Like.
Oh, my God, how perfectly titled.
Got sent to him because Mike also does the soundtrack for the whole film. And it's a really interesting experience watching it because it's really about is about passion, you know, and the idea that if you are passionate about what you do and you have something that, you know, that you love doing, then all the other things, because Mark is a real unique individual. He's very self-confident. He's a motor mouth.
Yeah.
He's a salesman. He has a key vision and he's quite abrasive and it takes you a second to kind of get into it. But then you start to realize what he's saying, which is like, look where I live. It's this really impoverished, like low socioeconomic area where people just accept that they have to work in factories. And, you know, I'm not going to be that. I don't care if it means that I'm fucking working shitty jobs left, right, and center. I'm a filmmaker and I'm going to make films. And it's just a beautiful message.
It really is. I mean, it's funny. I think, you know, people like you and I, Charlie, and you know, I imagine a lot of people listening to this podcast are like, will watch documentaries about filmmakers, but essentially, we're always watching documentaries about filmmakers who have made it.
This is the other side of Clerks. This is like if Kevin Smith's film Gamble hadn't paid off, this is what it would be. You just got a bunch of your mates together and you pulled whatever money together and you made this movie.
Yeah, and here's a guy who can clearly talk the talk and I think even to some degree walk the walk because, I mean,
he's been working since. I double-checked last night. He's actually done quite a bit since.
Yeah, you look at footage of Coven that they actually show in the film. It's like, if you slap the A24 logo on this, you know, and said it's a bold new vision trauma. From an uncompromising underground filmmaker, you might go, I'll hand them my money because I think they only they show you just enough of Coven to make you think Mark might have something, but then maybe he doesn't. Who knows? Like I said, you'll watch a documentary about filmmakers, and these are filmmakers who have, essentially hit a home run. It's like, now look at their early stuff and look at how, they're always confident from the get-go and they always, had the skills and all that. And, Mark has all that, but, the success that he clearly wants has eluded him. But, it's an interesting film and it's a heartwarming film, but at the same time, it's also unflinching and showing that, Mark can be kind of a dick.
Yeah.
And he's really quite a flawed individual.
And alcoholism is clearly out of control in that part of Wisconsin. Yeah. Like, there is so much drinking and talk about drinking. And I mean, I think it's, that's the joy of it or the beauty of it is that it's messy. Like, it shows that these people aren't perfect, but they all want to help Mark. Like, all his friends have things that they should be doing or would rather be doing, but they believe in Mark. Like, I think one of the actors says, look, the quality of his work probably is questionable, but what you can't question is how indomitable he is. Like, he's been making this short film for 3 years, and you do need that kind of drive and self-belief to make shit happen.
I jotted down a few lines because I rewatched it last night cool. And I think one of his actors says, "Oh, look, I can lose 10 weekends if it makes a lifelong dream come true."
That's nice.
It's like, that's really nice. And then I think his girlfriend at the time, Mark's girlfriend at the time, says, "If he pulls off 25% of what he's saying, that's more than most people ever accomplish ever." It's really, really great. And of course, Mark himself is, I don't know. This may seem like a bit of a sidetrack. David Fincher's film The Killer dropped on Netflix last week. I watched it over the weekend. There's a lot of inner monologue from the titular killer, and a lot of it sort of feels like self-help aphorisms or mantras to live by. And Mark does a lot of that in this movie, where he's talking about it's time to not drink and dream, but create and create and complete. I'm like, that's good. I want to write that on a post-it note and put it on my laptop. Yeah. But there's also just dialogue in here that, it's
him and Mike.
Him actually talking.
Him and Mike. I was thinking the same thing last night. I was like, this is brilliant comedy. Like, if someone like that scene where he needs Mike to go stick up the flyers around the university campus, and he walks off without the flyers, and he's like, "Mike, where are you going?" He's like, "I'm going to strategically hang up the flyers." And he's like, "But you don't have the flyers." And he's like, "Yeah, I know. That's why I'm asking you for flyers. No, I'm giving you the flyers." And it's like, who's on first? This is amazing.
But I mean, Mark's saying something like, I think he says to Mike, "What am I going to do? Suck down peppermint schnapps and call Morocco at 2 a.m? That's senseless," which is something he actually did. I mean, like, that's better than anything Kevin Smith ever wrote. And Kevin Smith's a pretty good screenwriter. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm going to keep quoting lines from American movies because there's a lot of stuff that's really good. But I think Mark also says, "No one ever paid admission to see an excuse." It's like, this guy's a real perfectionist and he's got a real vision, whether or not he's actually got the chops to translate from his head to his screen.
How normal his siblings appeared to be. Like, his two brothers they interview are so normal. Like, meeting his mum, who seemed a bit quirky, I'm like, oh yeah, I could sort of see. But then you meet his brothers, it's like, how did Mark come out so different to his brothers?
Yeah, well, doesn't his dad say, he qualified to go to the gifted school or something? Yeah,
but he quit.
Then he dropped out after a while because he didn't want to do that. But his brothers are saying, Mark's biggest gift is his mouth, and he's probably best suited to working in a factory. All this kind of stuff. There's this sort of passive aggression that you get in families occasionally. It's a really interesting stuff and a really interesting look at yeah, this chosen family, this creator, especially like his quote unquote brother Mike, who's, yeah, as you said, just the sweetest guy ever. I mean, the fact that he's talking about winning $50 on a scratchy, and that, like,
doesn't want to
tell it's the best thing that ever happened to him.
Doesn't want to tell anyone because they'll ask for it.
It doesn't want to because they'll all borrow money from him.
Well, then then later on he wins $200. And he's like, I have to give that's 60 right, to yeah. my, no, I gave 100 to my dad. I've got 60 at home. I've got 20 in my wallet. What do you want to do with it?
Yeah. Mark's like, we can go to the bar and drinks and get some pictures.
Yeah, four pictures of beer.
But it's, I also love that Mark is, you know, crunching his numbers and it's like, okay, I need to sell this many at this 3, amount. 000. And then he's like, no, I'm selling the top amount. He said, I need to sell $3,000 VHS copies of Coven.
At $15 each?
Apparently he's...
Is that right? Is
like, at like $15 a pop, like, yeah, back in 1999 shit. Or... apparently he sold more than 5,000
yeah.
at this stage. So well done, Mark.
Yeah, it's one of the best filmmaking documentaries you can watch. It's actually, I think a good companion piece would be to watch overnight,
the Troy Duffy one,
because you just get... Troy Duffy is such an unlikable, obnoxious fucking asshole. And you watch him, it's a riches to rags story. Whereas, you know, this one is such a more heartwarming, you know, let's put on a show kind of a documentary.
Yeah, American Movies is rags to rags. Yeah. But, yeah, the rags are kind of comfortable. They'll keep you warm on a cold Minnesota night.
It's all right. It's okay. Hey, Jesus told me so. There's something to live for.
Oh my God, Uncle Bill with his 300K fortune living in a trailer. What is it? He's in a caravan or a trailer or something. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But
we're gonna have to go again, Bill. I can hear your dentures clacking.
a fantastic movie, maybe not one you would necessarily show on a first date or something like that. But yeah, it's one that like I'm really into movies, and I think this is a great insight into low-budget movie making and the dreams that creative people have. Yeah, maybe don't lead with it, but I don't know, 3 or 4 dates down the line, it's like, this is a movie I really like.
And I think if you were ever a nerd who would peruse the horror section of a video store and, you know, getting into Romero and all that kind of stuff, like, you get where Mark's coming from. You get his references, you get who he wants to be. All of that stuff. So I think that's part of that's why so many film people love it is they were all Mark at one point. They were just someone who just loved these films and bought all the books and just wanted to be a filmmaker.
I love that, in the opening shot, you're sort of panning up through his bookshelves and, he's basically got all the holy texts there. He's got the Jedi library. Yeah,
exactly. All right, what's your first niche?
My first niche is by the great demented Canadian David Cronenberg. He's semi-reputable these days. I think, you know, what's that great line in Chinatown? You know, I'm old. Politicians, whores and ugly buildings get reputable if they stick around long enough. And David Cronenberg has been making movies for goodness knows how long. He's generally regarded as the king of body horror, but he's also regarded as like a bit of an elder statesman these days.
An occasional actor still pops up in things here and there. Loves a B-grade horror role from time to time.
He really showed up in Jason X.
That's right.
He's like
Nightbreed.
He's actually pretty good at me. He's got this lovely sort of calm but twisted demeanor about him, that suits those things so well, and that comes through in the movies that he makes. And one of them that's really good is, I believe this is from around 1982 or so. It's called Videodrome. Now, it's a movie that's got some, very deep, potent ideas about the culture that we consume, what it does to us, what we sort of put back into the world as a result of consuming this. What you're willing to sell in order to make a buck. It's full of interesting stuff, but it's also a movie where a TV basically turns into a giant mouth that consumes James Wood's head whole where a gun sort of melds itself to his hand and it shoots bullets that instantly give you cancer. I mean, these are not necessarily things that you're like, you meet someone who you're trying to maybe impress or at least make a good first impression on, say, You know what's pretty good is that that video drone by David Cronenberg, and they do a little bit of research, and then they never call you again.
Yeah, it's got an icky quality to the whole thing. Like, I mean, that's the whole point. Like, it's very much, you know, about sex and exploitation and violence and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know if, I mean, I can't, because it came out, I would have been five when it came out, but that idea of, you know, can violent entertainment, can it change people? Like, is it, you know, is it just entertainment, or does it have a more insidious cultural influence? Like, do you think that was sort of fairly cutting edge for the time? Because it feels like we're still having those conversations now with video games and rap music.
Yeah, it's a perpetual argument, isn't it? I mean, anytime anything really terrible happens in the culture, there's a knee-jerk reaction by certain sections of the community to go, well, they were clearly influenced by this. You know, they were influenced by the games they played or the music they listened to or the movies they watched. Yeah, and then Cronenberg, to his credit, addresses that in as thoughtful and deep and intelligent a way as you can when you're renowned as the, you know, king of body horror and the universal the studio, the sign of the checks, is like, we'd like some of that David Cronenberg goo.
Yeah.
We'd like some of that ick, as he pointed out. So, like, how do you fold those two together? And I think he does it pretty well in this case. But at the same time, he's also fairly unflinching with, you know, the way he presents things. I mean, this is a movie that's, yeah, extremely gooey, extremely bloody, and also traffics in...
stretchy. Gooey, you know, and stretchy.
Yeah. And also a lot of it, you know, S&M and kink, yeah, in it as well. I mean, I think one of my lines has always been, I'd love to meet a girl who is into, like, video drama and Crash, but at the same time, if I ever met this person, I would run a mile from them. But, I mean, this has Debbie Harry, the lead singer of Blondie, in not one of her first acting roles, but one of her first major acting roles. Because, I mean, I was surprised to learn that she actually wanted to be an actor more than a singer.
Oh, I didn't know.
She was
that.
Sort of hanging around the New York art scene of the late 70s and early 80s before forming Blondie. And when Blondie took off, it's like, oh, no, she's a singer. It's like, well, no, she's kind of a bit of a five-tool player. Yeah, right. And she's really good as the
radio host.
As the woman who sort of, yeah, who lures James Woods partially into this strange world of Videodrome. I'll give you the brief sort of synopsis. I mean, I don't want to blow too much, but James Woods is a guy who runs this cable TV station that specializes in what you might call adult programming. He's always looking for the next big thing. He kind of fancies himself a bit of a curator and a bit of an artist, even though he's really just a smut peddler. And his video pirate guy is like, oh, I found this transmission. We're not exactly sure where it's coming from. All it really is people getting tortured and brutalized and all this. And Woods sees a little bit of it and he goes, oh, yeah, I want it. I want to put that on the air. This is what I've been looking for. And it turns out there's a very sneaky and subversive plot behind it all. And watch the movie to find out the rest. But, yeah, things get weird and kinky from there. Yeah,
with a lot of body horror. And it's funny too, James Woods is one of those guys who has always looked 40 years old. Even when he was 20 and when he's 60, he looks 40. You know, he's got one of those faces. He's always been old.
Very much so. But, I mean, he's kind of like perfect casting for this
scuzzy
as well. Because, I mean,
he's inherent scuzziness.
But also with a degree of charm and obvious intelligence as well. I mean, his character in this is not exactly a moral exemplar, but the arguments that he puts for, like, this is why we show this kind of stuff. You know, yeah, well, I'm in it to make a buck, but also, you know, everyone's entitled to artistic expression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I'm kind of buying this from you, James Woods.
Yeah, he's the Larry Flint of TV entertainment. 1983, right, okay. Yeah, I mean, I reckon that's pretty – so MTV was just in its kind of early form, right? So
yeah.
There is something that feels like is maybe a bit was a bit predictive about it.
Yeah, and also you've got not the birth of VHS, but, you know, more people are watching movies at home as well. And, you know, I imagine with that comes a bit of pornography as well. I mean, you don't necessarily have to go out to the X-rated theater and potentially get busted by
Do you think Jason Blum is eyeing this off for a remake where some guy runs a website on the dark web where you can see any kind of shit. I mean, I feel like Blum, this is something. It's one of those titles where there's enough. It's not so well known that, you know, it's sacrosanct, yeah. But there's enough brand recognition that you could maybe remake it. And the themes seem like you could transport it to the modern day and it wouldn't lose anything.
I reckon so. And Blum's always got his eyes on the prize, so yeah, why not?
I saw an interview with John Carpenter a couple of days ago where he's talking about Blum coming to him and saying like that, you know, we're going to make it anyway. So like you're either get on board, you can do the music, don't worry about it. But apparently challenged him, said like if you're always complaining about these people remaking your films, actually make something. And then he was like, but it wasn't until he put the check in my hand. I was like, okay, sure, I'll care once you pay me.
I kind of love John Carpenter's late career. Well, not even late career. I think he's kind of been this way all the way through, but particularly him steering into the grumpy old man thing about like, yeah, all I want to do is just smoke pot, music, play video games and watch basketball. If they want to remake one of my movies, that's fine. They hand me a check. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. That's what he said, I think, was like, what are your favorite films? What are your favorite remakes? He's gone, the ones where they give me money and I don't have to do anything.
Now, whether Cronenberg feels that way, I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there have been too many remakes of his stuff. Apparently, they're doing like a TV series of Scanners, which I think is a really good idea.
And so the problem with remaking Cronenberg, a bit like the remake of The Thing, is like Cronenberg is so tied into body horror and it's that very visceral that you just don't get from CGI unless they would allowed the person to remake to go practical, then I think it's sort of a bit of a moot point. Because the, you know,
that's true. Yeah,
maybe not. I'm just thinking about The Fly. Maybe you just make The Fly completely different. You don't make it like his Fly. It's a remake in itself. So,
well, that's the thing. I mean, Cronenberg's remake of The Fly was, basically a 180 degree shift away from the original save me 50s monster movie Fly. And I think if you wanted to do a remake of it now, you know, 30, 40 years down the line, you'd have to find some other way to go 180 again rather than just slavishly redo it.
It'd just be horrible. Can you imagine some fucking studio remaking The Fly now? You know, it'd just be some CGI monstrosity. It'd be like one of those Zack Snyder grey fucking monsters at the end. Like, it would be no discernible features, no imagination.
And you'd have the trailer and would have an acoustic version. Of Fly by U2. Totally. Or Fly by Sugar Ray. I just want to fly.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned John Carpenter, and that actually brings me to my last niche recommendation, which I can't believe we haven't discussed on this. Carpenter's come up quite a bit on this show, but They Live, which is a cult hit. I'd say not his most popular film, but pretty well-regarded, particularly amongst movie nerds. But this is that one where I think there's so many kind of neat aspects of this film. Like, it's actually not his best film by a long shot, and the third act really falls apart. But it is
absolutely
so memorable, and it has such a real unique sensibility. You know, from the conceit of, you know, these aliens who have formed us into being, you know, controlled us into being consumers, to the idea of casting like Roddy Piper in the lead role, who is a very limited actor. But in this role, it kind of, like, he's nameless. Like, the character, I think it has no name at all.
In the credits, he's referred to as Nada, which is Spanish for nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, or
but
no
he's
one.
Not written, yeah. He's not addressed by anything during the film. But that's kind of what he needs to be, because he's a real kind of like an innocent when he sort of, you know, and there is some kind of it's a social commentary about the class system, and there is some kind of economic disparity, but you never quite get a sense of where it is or what's gone on or what's created. But I love that it has that kind of like I don't know what the word is. It's like an uncanny or a weird vibe through the whole kind of like first two acts.
A phrase I use a bit, and I ripped it off from David Lynch's Room to Dream. You know, I mean, you're given just enough information. It's like to buy in. It's like, but if you start thinking about how have they colorized us? What I mean, if I take off these, you know, if I put on the glasses, is the real world actually black and white all the time? I mean, it's there are ideas, and it's kind of like, this makes no sense if I try to unravel it. But, and it's a word that gets overused a lot, but the vibe of it makes sense. It's like we're being oppressed, okay? We're essentially the underclass, and we've been sold this bill of goods by people who hold all the power. Everyone has felt powerless at some stage, so of course you're going to buy into that. But, the fact that it's done in – it's wrapped in the skin of this B-movie, essentially. I mean,
it's not quite an action movie. It's not quite like an art house film. It's this kind of weird combination of all these like different it kind of – like Sorry to Bother You, when Sorry to Bother You came out, I felt like that was like a comedic version of They Live. Like it sort of has this kind of like, it's social commentary, but they go really like far out in terms of the comedy. Whereas this has moments of sort of like, I don't know if it's unintended comedy, but like the fight scene, for instance, that 14 minute alley fight, which is so brutal, but realistic, but also kind of funny. And like, it's amazing in the sense that this 14 minute bit of physicality has levels. Like it has its own arc.
It's just great to watch in terms of a the choreography and everything involved in it, because of course Rowdy Piper was a wrestler. He knows how to move around the ring. Keith David was like a Juilliard trained actor, but clearly physical. He's no slouch when it comes to physicality as well. But I love how it's got this.
They get animosity tired. They in have there, to take a determination, break. And then they start fighting.
They get
again.
Tired. They have to take a break, and it gets to a stage where I think Roddy picks up a plank at some stage, takes a swing, and he busts the windscreen or something. And he realizes,
I would have killed him.
Oh shit! I really could have hurt you, man. I'm sorry. He sort of throws it down, and then they start beating the crap out of one another.
What about like the little detail of like when he's beating Keith David's head against the concrete, and because Keith David's bald, you see like a graze appearing, and for some reason,
you do see it on
of all the movie injuries I've seen, that one to me, it feels the most kind of visceral and real. I'm like, oh god, he's ripping the skin off the back of his head.
It's one of the best things I've read about Carpenter's The Thing was. I mean, that's a movie that's just full of again body horror. Things transforming and being sort of ripped asunder and all that. The scene that makes people wince the most is when they're doing the blood test and they've got the scalpel and they're cutting everyone's thumb. It was like, well, I've got no idea what it would like to be have an alien entity inside of me, turning me into something else. But, ooh, I gave myself a wicked paper cut one time and that sucked. But, They Live. I mean, I get the feeling if you were trying to I think you could explain it to someone pretty well and explain the deeper ideas and stuff that goes into it. But if you showed it to someone for the first time, they'd be going, this looks like it was made for $5. That guy's not a very good actor. Is he a wrestler? Yeah,
I mean, I think have to be sort of versed in like cinema to get it, because it would come across nowadays as so heavy-handed because it's been ripped off heaps as well. Like every fucking music video that, the band wants to make a point will have some kind of, buy this, consume this, reproduce like that. But at the time it was like, It was quite an adventurous kind of interesting choice for this weird sci-fi action film to make.
Absolutely, I mean, you've got a lot of horror nerds saying, "Oh, you know what? I really miss the days when, my movies weren't beating me over the head with the message or something like that." And it's weird because They Live is really beating you over the head with the message, but it doesn't sort of feel like that. I mean, the subtext almost feels like text in a lot of ways, but at the same time, when you mention They Live to some people, they'll go, "Isn't that movie where they fight in the alley for like 8 minutes straight? It's so good." I don't know. I mean, it's a really good combination of crowd pleasing, but also
weird.
I've got ideas that I want to express. Yeah,
it's funny. Sometimes something can be so strange and unique that that's actually what makes it appealing. Like, there's just for all its flaws and the inconsistency and stuff, it just feels there's just so much weirdness and strange elements, like the professional wrestler lead man, the tonal shift, the social commentary with the action component. Like even that, the greatest line in the film, "I've come here to chew bubble gum and kick ass," like is so out of place in the movie. Like it doesn't really make any sense why suddenly this Nada, who's been this kind of like a bit of a naive doofus, suddenly becomes this cool action hero for a second. And
yeah. When his eyes open, they really open. I mean, he's been kind of a, not a passive nice guy through all this, but he's, you know, he's got his lines about, you know, I believe in America. If I work hard, you know, things are going to go my way. It's going to be fine. He puts on the glasses, realizes the deck is stacked, and it's a real 180 turn. It's like, well, I'm grabbing a shotgun and I'm blowing away every alien I see now, even though they look human to everybody else. It's such an odd film, but in a great way, and a really, really sort of angry film. I mean, it's, you know, Carpenter's often said that, you know, it's his response to Reaganism. You know, he saw that the great, I don't know if you even call it an experiment of Reaganism, but you know, a lot of people did well, but a whole lot more people got fucked over. And yeah, this is him expressing that by virtue of, Rowdy Roddy Piper going buck wild with a shotgun.
Formaldehyde face.
You look like your face fell in the cheese dip back in 1957.
What is your last niche movie?
My last niche movie may not seem that niche when you're talking about a collaboration between Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, the rom-com darlings of the 1990s. But this was the first movie that they appeared in together before Sleepless in Seattle and You've Got Mail, and it's called Joe versus the Volcano.
Yes. Now, you've brought this movie up before. This is one of your all-time favorites, I believe.
It really is. I love it a whole lot. But at the same time, it's also so stylized and so idiosyncratic that it's, yeah, not one that you would sort of hesitate to recommend, but it's like, I'm recommending this, but with disclaimers. I mean, this is not going to be Sleepless in Seattle going, and you should know that this is kind of a fairy tale about a guy who has been sleepwalking through his life. He's a hypochondriac, and he's finally given a diagnosis like, oh, you actually have an incurable disease that's going to kill you. It's not going to hurt, but one day you're just going to blank out. And then he's given this odd offer by a billionaire who says, I need someone to be a human sacrifice on an island in the South Pacific. I need you to jump into a volcano so I can then exploit the natives of this island and take their minerals. And he's like, yeah, I'll give you all this money. You know, you can live like a king for the last few weeks of your life. You can travel on a boat to this island in the South Pacific, but then you got to jump into a volcano. And Tom Hanks is like, I got nothing to live for. Fine, I'll do it. But along the way, he sort of rediscovers his zest for living because Meg Ryan is the captain of the boat. They fall in love. But he's like, I've got to be brave. I made this commitment to jump into the volcano, but I love you, but I got to jump into the volcano. It's about, without risk of sounding too new agey, you know, becoming who you are, becoming your own hero. And it's done in such a lovely way, but also a very quirky way. It's like, I mean, I showed this to my girlfriend. I don't know. I think we'd been going for maybe 3 months, and I thought,
this is the
we've got a bottle of wine. I'm going to hit it with the double whammy of like
a warmer up with talented Mr. Ripley. Joe versus the- we'll get into Joe versus the Volcano.
Actually, it was Joe versus the Volcano and Royal Tenenbaums. I'm like, I might as well give her maximum quirk. Yeah. You know, if we're still together after tonight, that's it. You're never getting rid of me. Throwing away the key. And it worked. Even watching it as someone who loves it and not trying to watch it through their eyes, but trying to gauge their reaction, I'm like, are they getting this? I hope they get this, you know. Louise, to her credit, of course. She got it. I don't know. It's just a movie that I really,
it's
really
funny,
enjoy.
Like, because I've read a lot of articles about, like, where are the comedies these days? Like, what happened to kind of, like, cinematic comedies? It seems to be, like, you have to – Deadpool is considered a comedy. And I'm like, what, really? Like, but you don't get – you don't get sort of, or even high concept, you know, Groundhog Day type films. Like, you don't get those $20 to $30 million films. Do you think that it's a case of people just aren't willing to go out and like see stories like this, which is ultimately inconsequential? It's obviously like a farcical kind of premise. And it's just not enough to get people to a cinema or to studios have confidence to back a film like this?
I think it, I mean, not to sort of play industry statistician or something like that, but you read about, oh, we're really reliant on the international dollar now, and comedy is something that doesn't really travel.
Very reasonable.
So, you know, the people signing the checks get a little bit gun-shy. Having said that, I mean, if you look on, you know, your streaming services or your pay TV services, that stuff like that still gets made. I mean, we're in season three of The Righteous Gemstones with, you know, Danny McBride and David Gordon Green, the guys who, you know, help bring you Pineapple Express and other things like that. So I think these stories are still getting told, maybe to a lesser degree, and also with different delivery systems. So, I mean, I think comedy still exists. Maybe more of it exists like on YouTube these days, or even
I did read one comedian talk about how he felt like cinema and comedy were kind of at odds with each other, in the sense that comedy shouldn't look great. Like, you don't want, you know, like, you know, some amazing cinematographer and editor and director, like, composing a frame perfectly. Like, comedy works better when it's rough and ready, when it's warts and all. And I'm like, oh, I can sort of see that. And that would explain why, like, Borat and, you know, those kind of style of comedies, or Jackass, that kind of stuff, which is, like, more realistic or grounded, have been the more successful ones of recent years that haven't had a superhero. I was shocked by the Deadpool being the highest grossing comedy of the last 10 years. That was like, I didn't even realize it was. I mean, I know it's a comedy, but I would not have put it in that category.
I guess it's quote unquote funny. Yeah, but you wouldn't put it in the comedy section.
No, but it counts.
No. It's funny you mentioned
that. And Deadpool 2 is like the third highest like grossing.
Oh, like, my God.
No, it's shocking.
And Deadpool 3 is coming out next year. So
there you go. Yep.
Mark a spot for that on the mantle. I watched this documentary about Albert Brooks the other day, and they had footage from his movies. And, you wouldn't look at them going, wow, this guy really knows where to put the camera, or, you know, oh, that's incredible shot composition or mise-en-scène or whatever. But it's like, this is still some of the funniest shit ever. I mean, even the Judd Apatow comedies of like a decade ago.
They look like TV.
Yeah, these are fairly – they kind of got TV blocking, a lot of medium shots and all that kind of stuff. They're not exactly
filmmakers,
you know, making the most of the frame.
I guess that there would be there would be an exception to the rule. Like, I think if you look at, he doesn't really make comedy though. So I was thinking like Jordan Peele, he's doing more satire now. Like, you know, I think Nope was quite satirical, and he's clearly a good filmmaker, but it's not comedy, is it?
Yeah, I'm wondering how much say he had behind the camera with the stuff that appeared on Key and Peele, because that had a real cinematic bent to it. A lot of the sketches they did. There's the great one that Peele did where he's playing like baby Forrest Whitaker. Ever seen that one?
I haven't seen that.
Oh, Key is like a babysitter, and they've CG'd Peele's head onto a baby's body, but Peele is doing like a Forrest Whitaker face, and he's doing this note perfect Forrest Whitaker impersonation. So saying, you know, he's got the eye, but he's also got Forrest Whitaker's really distinctive way of talking, particularly when he's trying to be threatening. It's like you can really see the origins of like Nope and Us in that. It's like, this is really disturbing, but also kind of funny. I don't know exactly how to feel. Yeah, but yeah, most comedies, you're right, they don't necessarily have a slickness to them. Ben Stiller maybe is a comedy director who, I don't know, tends to pride himself on his visuals.
You're right. Edgar Wright, you know, when he does comedy, but
I never got back to you about where I think we're just entering the conversation phase of the of the podcast now, as opposed to talking about it. But I watched Last Night in Soho, Edgar Wright's movie, and I think you contacted me on Twitter and said, I want to know what you think of this, because and you're right. I mean, for the first maybe two-thirds, I was like, oh, this is well put together, and I think I'm in. And then the final third just completely shits the bed.
It's so underwhelming and unoriginal. Like, I sort of feel like he's so Tarantino wears his influences on his sleeves, but then you feel like he puts a new spin on it. Whereas I think Edgar Wright just wears his influences on his sleeves, and that's about it.
Well, he's a fantastic technician. I mean, I don't think Baby Driver works completely, but there's moments of choreography in that that are just brilliant. And likewise in Last Night to Soho, I mean, there's you know, lovely transitions and, you know, a great sort of setting a mood of all that kind of stuff. But
I think Edgar Wright, I sort of put him in a similar category to like someone like Tim Burton, which is like amazing world builder, amazing technician, but the characters, like, they seem to dislike or have no connection to the characters because you don't like any of them. They're not memorable. Like, they're not interesting or memorable.
Yeah, and I don't think he is either interested or has the capacity to sort of get down in the dirt with it. I mean, I mentioned David Fincher earlier. He seems like someone who's got his share of perversions and is not afraid to
indulge.
You know, sort of make those manifest on screen. Or, you know, old school guys like Paul Verhoeven or Brian De Palma. It's like, these guys are dyed-in-the-wool perverts. and they really just want to they're happy to express that. It's like, this is going to make my movie even better if I sort of show you what a freak I am. Because I'm betting that you're a freak too.
To bring it full circle, when Mike Shank, when it was announced that he'd passed away, I saw Edgar Wright wrote a very touching tribute to Mike Shank in American Movie. He said that he and Simon Pegg saw that film like a number of times and even wrote a way to get their own copy of Coven sent to them. I'm never going to get that right. I'm still not exactly sure what the correct pronunciation is. Guy, thank you so much. I know it's been a long time. It's been great to crack open the video store and blow the dust off a few of our old favorites. Where can people find you?
If you want to find me on social media, I am at Robert Guy Davis on Twitter. If you are looking for a podcast that does not have Charlie Clausen involved in it, feel free to listen to something on the Four Finger Discount Network, where me and my co-host Brendan Dando will talk about The Simpsons is our flagship show, but we also talk about South Park, Seinfeld, Futurama, King of the Hill, do the odd movie review.
Are you guys going to a daily podcast? Did I read that right? Did I read something online that you guys are doing daily shows now?
It almost feels that way. I mean, I only appear on a few of them, but Dando, my co-host, he has a few other sort of side hustles and side projects. So there's pretty much something for almost every day.
Four Finger Discount. There'll be a link in the episode description. Guy, thank you so much for coming back on. I'm Charlie Clausen.
I'm Guy Davis. Thanks again, Charlie.
Listener.